EMSradio.com.
EMS information for the next generation.
The EMS Garage is a production of EMSradio.com. You can find us on Facebook, just search EMS Garage. You can find us on Twitter at EMS Garage. Email us, emsgarage@gmail.com, or call us, 303-720-6001.
The EMS Garage.
Hello and welcome to this edition of EMS Garage. My name is Scott Keir, and I am personally back from my six-month hiatus of getting my career straightened out. And after a long talk with Chris Montero at EMS Today, we decided that we are going to go with a full-court press on EMS Garage and try and get some more content out there to everybody, because we know how much you love listening to us talk. In addition to that, I'm looking to bring some new people into the fold, as well as some old voices. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome back, first of all, my brother in this podcasting world, kind of from my inception in it, RJ Stein. How you doing?
You called me first. I had a big wad of pizza in my mouth, so.
You know the rules. Come on. Wash it down with a swig of beer, and we are fine.
Hey, Angry Orchard, man. That's where it's at. This is not a product endorsement. I'm not being paid by Angry Orchard. It's just really good. So what's up?
Not much. Just glad to be back to podcasting. I'm going to do my best in this intro to not talk about the weather with anybody, because the second most popular thing, actually third most, behind beer and EMS to talk about in EMS Garage is the weather.
Yeah, I'm not going to mention it as well.
Well, fantastic.
Awesome.
Well, good to have you back on, man.
Yeah.
Also joining us tonight, very well known throughout the blogging world and the podcasting world, the ever so calm and complacent Tim Noonan. How you doing, Tim?
Hello. Hello.
Well, sorry about that. I hit the wrong button. How's things out your way, man?
The weather is nice.
Oh, well.
Ruined it already.
Exactly. Well, Tim, good to have you back on. I'm looking forward to talking to you about our topic tonight. Also rejoining us from the lovely state of Iowa in the Midwest is Brad Buck. Evening, Brad.
Doing good. It's kind of cool to be back on here. It's been a long time since I've been involved with anything EMS Garage, to be honest with you.
Well, it's really good to have you back on, and we're going to be doing a lot more of this, so your name's on the list.
Cool.
And
this new host seems like a pretty cool guy.
He's really overrated. lastly, but not leastly, we have a first-time guest joining us, Mr. Ben Neal. How you doing, sir?
Not doing too bad. I won't talk about the weather, but I will talk about delicious Kentucky bourbon.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure everybody has a decent idea of who Brad, Tim, and myself are, and RJ, of course. Why don't you tell us a little about yourself and where you're from and what you do?
Well, I've been on Twitter for quite some time, made some good friends like yourself and RJ from back in the day, and finally actually got to meet some people. The last EMS conference in Las Vegas, and then the most recent one here in New Orleans, or there in New Orleans. I work for a third service municipal EMS agency that does about 100,000 runs a year. We run 30 ambulances, combination ALS, BLS. Nothing outrageous, nothing too crazy, but it's good fun. Trying to make things different, make things better.
And I really think that's kind of why we're all here. And it's good that you mentioned the type of service that you're in, and that's really the reason that I wanted to get, you know, all four of you on with me tonight. You know, we've got RJ, who works in a Firebase system, Brad, who's in a hospital-based system, and Tim, who works full-time in the private system. And I really want to hear everybody's perspective on what we're going to be talking about tonight, and that is a little annual conference that they have called the Gathering of the Eagles. Now, personally, I am not – I have never attended the Gathering of the Eagles. Brad, I know you have, so can you just kind of give everybody the little nickel and dime version of what it is?
Be happy to. Basically, it is a conference that don't quote me as to how many years ago they first started it, but it was started with City of Pittsburgh EMS asking their current medical director if he could himself and maybe a couple others get together, do just a little get-together on some maybe what's coming down the pipe for EMS and emergency medicine. And it kind of exploded, where now it's about the 40 or 50 largest cities, municipalities, I guess, in the country. And then they pull in the UK, Australia, the feds. And there's some others that maybe aren't that top 50 that get to play a role in it. But it's basically some of the leading medical directors, like if you think of like Dr. Brett Meyer, someone like that. And it's usually pretty good, at least fairly somewhat evidence-based medicine. A lot of it, it's kind of what their services are doing or what they're implementing for changes. You know, a lot of it involves research. And kind of things that for the rest of us we may not get to for a few years. But the nice thing about it is it's I like the fact it's physicians, and they're only about 10 or 15-minute long sessions. You know, so you get about, I don't know, maybe 50 or 60 or so in the 2 days that you're there. So it's just long enough that the shiny, flashy things don't really pull our attention away from what they're talking about.
Yeah, I was looking over the brochure from this year's, actually. I was perusing it, and that's really a lot of what you see, you know, 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there, 15 minutes here. And that's like a fascinating concept for me, that you're getting these people up there and it's just kind of like a boom, 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 hit you from the left, hit you from the right, and let's move on to the next thing. And it's just a really interesting way to do a conference.
I think it's a great format. A lot of people like it. And then afterwards, as you know, physician XYZ is walking down and towards the back of the auditorium to walk out, you know, people are hopping up to go and talk to him, you know, get a number, get an email address, anything like that. And you know, I tend to probably, there's quite a few of them, where then I'll shoot an email or talk to him a little bit afterwards to find out a little bit more about what they are discussing, if it's something that was of interest to me.
Terrific. Now, Tim, was this your first year there, or had you been there before?
Yes, it was the first year where my ego was big enough for the gathering.
Did everybody say, oh, my God, that's Tim Noonan, the Rogue Medic?
Actually, I did get something sent to Facebook by Bill Toon saying, what? Is that the Rogue Medic back there? Because I asked a question, and my voice apparently is not one that sounds like everybody else's.
Now, Tim, I can admit, when you asked that question, Matt and I had been talking. It's like, have you seen Tim this morning? No. And all of a sudden, there's a question from the back of the room, and it's like, oh, there he is.
The EMS Sasquatch.
Exactly. Now, Tim, knowing, as we all know, you know, the stuff that you post on roguemedic.com and a lot of your views and your thoughts on the direction that we should be going with a lot of treatments, epinephrine, pain management, et cetera, and so forth. What was your impression? Are they on the right track? Are they going in the right direction?
Yeah, in most things. The pain management discussion there, Brad and Matt and I had a podcast that we did up in Brad's hotel room the night before, and it was like listening to our podcast, the presentation from forget who it was.
Tim, I can't remember either which doc it was.
Caldwell.
And it really was. It was funny because, yeah, Tim, we knew what the topic was going to be. And, you know, as far as looking over the agenda, and we just talked on our own, and it was quite funny that a lot of the conversation and discussion the next day by the physician was exactly what we had been talking about.
Yeah, it's Christopher Caldwell, Denver Paramedics Medical Director. And it was great to hear somebody who is medical director and is as aggressive as I think we should be. A lot of times the medical directors are afraid to be aggressive because they know there are some people they have working for them that might not be entirely safe with aggressive dosing of opioids or other medications. And the solution to that is to raise the standards, not to lower the protocols.
That was one of my recent rants as well, is accommodating to the lowest common denominator and how it kind of brings us down in that aspect, but I just want to throw that in.
Now, Ben, as somebody who's newer to the conference circuit and stuff, I mean, what was your opinion about this whole conference and everything that you were seeing and everything that was going on around you?
Well, I mean, you know, just going with, you know, my previous experiences, I've been to the two EMS World Expos, and it's something totally different, you know, kind of like what Brad touched on. You know, you get a big room with 600, 700, 800 people that are just, you know, and just rapid fire. There's so many great ideas and so many great people. I mean, just it's amazing to me to have all those minds and, you know, all that forethought that's just right there in front of you. And again, what Brad said, you know, you can literally go up and shake somebody's hand and say thank you so much and pick their brain. And to me, that's a big deal. With the EMS world, you know, you kind of go in and out of this room and you got to try to plan your schedule. Well, your schedule is pretty much set with the Eagles. And I did like that a lot.
That's very cool. And Brad, just from coming back, I mean, from being there previously, are you seeing an evolution? Are you seeing, you know, the EMS leaders moving along with the field?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'll use an example here, Scott. When I went, I went in 2011 and I missed last year. And after last year, I swore I'd never miss it again. But in 2011, the medical director for the city of Miami, she was talking about the changes in ACLS. And she referred to the fact of, you know, you can look at the Heart Association stuff and take it somewhat with it, some of it with a grain of salt. And she was already discussing this. Okay, why are we using epinephrine when there's no scientific evidence that it doesn't hurt things and yet it doesn't make any things better? So, you know, toss it out or don't administer it. It's not going to change an outcome of a patient, you know, in like VFib, cardiac arrest and such. And so there's some of that kind of conversation. The spinal immobilization thing was briefly discussed. I believe that's going to be a huge topic next year. But I still think for the most part these guys are definitely forward thinking, and they can show why some of the changes and why a handful of changes and processes that are taking place in EMS services across the country, and they're coming in because they have a larger volume of patients, larger number of calls. They're able to pull some data that kind of shows where something's working or not working. So it's kind of good where, you know, for me only having about, you know, 10 to 12,000 calls a year, you know, I can see somewhat, but it looks better when you've got someone showing you the data with 200 or 300,000 calls a year.
Now, I look through this list of classes and little subsets to the sessions and stuff, and I'm seeing, you know, just a large variety of things. I'm seeing, you know, the evolving considerations in out-of-hospital care. I'm seeing experiences with recent disasters and historical tragedies, 13 ways for dealing with STEMIs and transplants, et cetera. Ben, which one did you feel that you really got the most out of this whole list here?
Oh, I mean, like you said, you look at this and there's so many different topics. There's so much information. I mean, I literally got writer's cramp taking notes. Next year, I'm taking my computer and just recording it. But one of the big things that I kind of gathered was the community paramedicine thing. You know, community paramedicine and mobile integrated healthcare, whatever you want to call it. You know, we've been preaching it for so long, and it's here. It's going to stay, and it's going to work. And there were several presentations that I read or, you know, took on that. And I love getting ideas from other places, see what they're doing to try to implement it in our service. And they've got a lot of really good ideas, I'll say that. That's pretty much what I've gathered from them.
Well, I guess here's my big question then. First of all, for Tim, just again, because I know how you feel about a lot of this stuff. Do you feel the community paramedicine track is the way to go with the industry? Do you feel that that's the direction we need to be moving?
I don't know. It's something where we need to change how we educate if we're going to do it. Saying that we can just tell medics, you have a different protocol, go over here and you know, do this differently. You're not going to transport to a hospital. You're going to be responsible for all the things that the nurse had previously been doing, you know, volunteer nurses, community nurses, and stuff like that. That's a way to get in trouble. We need to make sure that we have things thought out and that the paramedics are well prepared. And it seems like the communities that are doing it are doing things that way. But the more we spread out, the more likely we are to end up with lesser prepared medics, which won't work well.
Well, and I guess the second part of that question is, you know, there's five of us on this call right now who work in five very unique systems with ultimately the same goal. Is anybody here in a system that is currently laying the groundwork for community paramedicine moving in that direction?
We are, for my service. That's one of the main reasons that our medical director, who is an Eagle, wanted us to come out there. He actually wanted us to go out and shadow some of the people out at Fort Worth. And it's amazing what they're doing. And, you know, I think that's a great role for paramedics in the future. Anything that broadens our horizons and makes us a little bit more valuable is, you know, that's invaluable to me.
RJ, Tim, RJ?
We've kind of reached a point now where we've started using an alternate response vehicle. And, you know, we've kind of looked ahead into the future as far as our EMS delivery goes. And I said this 2 years ago that eventually they're going to come to us with a plan to deploy these. And sure enough, you know, 6 months after they put them out in the field, they came to EMS and said, well, what's the plan? And we kind of looked at each other like, you know, nobody bothered to even think about it. But I think in about 5 years, we're going to see them deployed in a different manner when we're paramedic heavy, we might actually see that kind of a community paramedicine model where their squads is our terminology, is that the squad goes out to say a sick person call where they've one of those low priority six alpha whatever calls, you know, and they make those decisions on scene like, well, you know, you don't need an ambulance transport necessarily, you know, but you do need to be seen at some sort of alternative pathway like a clinic or something like that. So I think we're starting to see that kind of laid accidentally by our fire component, actually, they kind of deployed those squads as a cost saving measure, but I see them being used in the next 5 or 6 years as more of a first response and a need determinant. You know, like, you know, you could probably go to a clinic, you know, here's a list of the closest clinics and you know, type stuff. Is I think that's where we're going with that.
Well, and you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, and I guess here's my big question. In the current system that I'm working in the state that I am working in, the most frequent user of the 911 medical system is a walk-in healthcare facility. They are sending people out left and right to the hospital. So I guess my big question is, you know, the community paramedicine push is happening. You know, there's a lot of people that are really spearheading it and really doing a very strong job with it. Matt Zavadsky, Chris Montero, Gary Wingrove. But do we need to be the ones that are moving first, or should we be following in the steps of healthcare? I mean, because if we're gonna put in these alternate destinations, or we're gonna take these people to different places, or we're gonna send them to different places, if those pathways are just gonna feed into the same system, are we even solving anything?
I lost my train of thought. I would, you know, that's kind of the opposite with us, is that our primary users are low income, you know, Medicaid recipients, and that's terming it nicely sometimes. So I think it would be a benefit if we use that type of screening ahead of time to utilize alternate pathways. Obviously, we don't have, you know, obviously they're not using the clinics, you know, with us because they're calling 911. So they don't know the clinics exist, or they can't get in, or some other problem like that. So it's kind of a, you know, we're trying to catch those people that don't, you know, don't even know primary care exists.
Well, as a population, I think you're right. You know, you're going to find that the lower end is going to be the one that's calling most frequently. But I'm talking about the single caller is a healthcare facility. And, I mean, where does that land us? Tim, Brad, Ben, are we the ones who need to be moving first, or do we need to be following healthcare and healthcare needs to be leading us?
I think the doctors need to talk to the doctors. You're not going to get a lot of doctors will respond to a medic saying, you're doing something wrong. But when they talk to each other, they're more likely to actually communicate.
Brad, you had something to add?
Hey, Scott, it's Brad. Yeah, I think this is one of those places, exactly what you're discussing, and with, you know, your largest user being a kind of an outpatient clinic-y or walk-in clinic type of a place. I think with some of the changes in healthcare and within the insurance industry and, you know, the Affordable Healthcare Act and such, I think that places like that are going to, for lack of a better term, be forced to, you know, change their ways. The same as, you know, some of our probably biggest callers are some of the care facilities and nursing homes, because instead of the physician coming in to evaluate the patient, it's easier for the physician on a Friday night to just say, send them to the ER, where then an hour later they're being sent back to said nursing home on something that was simple and could have been dealt with there. I really don't think that Medicare or insurance in general, and we can probably figure in the next 5 to 10 years, that any of that is going to be covered. And I also believe that the feds will hold physicians more responsible for those sorts of actions.
And I really hope so.
In sense on it.
I really, really hope you're right. And, I mean, obviously there are legitimate patients that go to a walk-in clinic that probably should have stayed home and picked up the phone and called 911 on their own. But then there's the other sector of the population that is actually doing what everybody in EMS seems to want to ask them to do. And
sure,
for those people just to take the same pathway, you know, to take a different road to the same town, basically, is what it comes down to. You know, it's a very tough thing to deal with. So I, you know, let's just talk about the elephant in the corner of the room with the Gathering of the Eagles. Obviously, there's great content. There is terrific content. I'm salivating looking at this list of classes and looking at this list of topics. But where do you go with it from here? I mean, Brad, Tim, you guys are big with your, you know, you're getting back into the Standing Orders podcast, and I know that deals a lot with medical directors and sharing a lot with them. How do you go about getting this information out to your medical director? I'm sure, you know, in my old system, if I walked up to my medical director and said, hey, how about that Gathering of the Eagles? He would have looked at me sideways and thought, as, you know, RJ said before we even started, that I was talking about some Washington State Eagle Preserve that was out there. But, you know, how do you share this, and how do you get your system to integrate with all of these great ideas and what you can see as, you know, industry leading ideas?
Scott, it's Brad. For me, it's coming in a couple of manners. One, I applied basically, for lack of a better term, a scholarship to be able to attend this. So my hospital paid for it. And there's a lot of discussion in our hospital now as far as evidence-based medicine. And it's becoming a regular topic. Once a month, there's for nurses, physicians, hospital staff, there's these discussions. So that's what some of this is. Some of the ideas here and some of the things they're trying to change, there's evidence that shows that it works or doesn't. So I'm able to come back with some of this, and I have to present a paper to the committee that gave me the money. And I have to say, look, you know, here's what's happening. Here is what is here's what's going on. Here's why we need to implement these changes. And you know, here's the evidence, here's the science, here's the research, here are the papers to show them, and we can go from there. And unfortunately, I do have a lot of issues with my medical direction. You know, RJ, you are so extremely fortunate, and then as well for the fact that you have a medical director that was interested in wanting you to go there, RJ, with your medical director being an Eagle. But for us, it's a little harder. But our hospital, I mean, they're looking at ways to improve, make us, if you want to call it, more efficient. And just if we can start to see where we can improve patient outcomes, that's what I'm really looking for.
So, you know, obviously, Brad, you touched on it right there. And you know, the thing that the person listening can't see is our little side chat that we have going on here in Skype. RJ, I'll just put you right on the spot. What changes and evolutions have you seen in your system that you feel are as a result of the, you know, the gathering of the Eagles?
Well, you guys were talking about the STEMI golden hour, you know, before the cat, you know, what our doctor, Dr. Holly, you know, was presenting on, is that we've, you know, that's based on solid data that we've contributed to, that I actually feel like I'm a part of it, because, you know, I've hauled a lot of those STEMIs that he's talking about as far as data goes. So, you know, he implements a lot of those changes to us, and, you know, and when the Eagles come through and say, oh, you know, this is the next big thing, is that we're one of the next people to feel it. Is that he, you know, if he thinks it's a great idea, you know, if he wants to see more data on it, you know, we're going to try it and we're going to see what happens. And, you know, and sometimes, you know, I kind of feel like I'm, you know, and I said in the side chat, is that I kind of feel like I'm holding some of you guys at a disadvantage, because my medical director, you know, is part of it. And by extension myself, I'm a part of it. So whenever we, you know, whenever we're deploying things like this, you know, some of you guys may have seen, you know, on the interwebs lately, is that, you know, our new purchase of Lucas, is that those Lucas devices, you know, were part of those changes that he was talking about as far as mechanical CPR goes. You know, and we're buying, we have one, you know, we have 36 of them in the field, or we will by the end of the week. So, I mean, it's, you know, we're making the changes slowly, progressively, but I mean, we're doing our, you know.
You know, you're moving a lot farther than a lot of people are, though. You know, that's awesome that you guys are getting them, that, you know, your medical director is taking the time to kind of push those issues. Tim, coming from, you know, in the eyes of a private paramedic, and me being the graduate, if you will, of a private system, I always found that there were instances where it wasn't just a medical director issue for passing along ideas and progressing the system, but sometimes it was also a company issue, if you will. What influence, if any, do you feel that these kind of conferences should have on, you know, the ownership and if you will, a board of directors of a private ambulance service, and how do you communicate what you saw down in Dallas to them?
With our company, it's a small company, and I've known one of the owners as long as I've been in Pennsylvania, and that's the reason I went to work there. We have statewide protocols, and on Friday they just released an update, and I was very disappointed. I was expecting, we've had some significant changes with each of the previous revisions of the protocols, and the only real changes to this are minor. They said they were going to look at the Rampart study, which was covered in last year's Gathering of Eagles, which showed that if you used intramuscular Versed at 10 milligrams for anyone over, I think it was 44 kilos, versus 4 milligrams of Ativan IV, the Versed worked quicker, more reliably, because you don't have to mess around with trying to start an IV on somebody who's in the middle of a seizure. Even an IO line drilling into somebody who's actively seizing, not going to go that smoothly. I think the only thing they did is they added intramuscular and intranasal to the adult scope of practice, but or to the adult protocols. They were already in our scope of practice. They were not in the protocols. But we're still at half the dose that they used in the study. So we're using a completely inadequate dose. And, you know, we're just setting ourselves up for failure. And a lot of EMS systems do not realize that they're using much too small a dose of benzodiazepine. One of the studies that Rampart referenced was comparing Valium, I think it was Ativan, and placebo. And they showed that the airway compromise, the rate of intubation, was higher without any benzodiazepine than with even high doses of benzodiazepine. So, you know, we're focused on the wrong things. If we can't treat seizures right with an auto-injector, you know, going for complicated things like STEMI treatment, where it is more complex, doesn't go that smoothly.
Agreed. Now, Ben, you said something in chat that kind of stuck with me here, and I'm gonna, you know, obviously not take your words out of your mouth, but after learning everything that you learned and hearing everything that you heard, you know, you're listening to medical directors, you're listening to the people who really truly should be probably guiding our practice on a nationwide basis. Who do you need to be writing protocols for? What quality of paramedic do we need to look for, and how do you address that?
Well, the sad thing is I spoke with the medical director before our current one came in, and, you know, took him some ideas, you know, different things here and there that were said, whatnot. And that was the response that I got was, you know, your protocols can only be as smart as your dumbest paramedic. And, you know, to me, it just kind of struck a nerve because it's taking credibility away from your good ones. And, you know, if you have subpar paramedics that, you know, are the dumbest paramedics, then why aren't you re-educating them? Why aren't you trying to fix the problem as opposed to, you know, you need to fix the problem as opposed to just saying, oh, no, we're not going to do that because, you know, so-and-so. And that's just, it's asinine to me that, you know, as a career field with that kind of attitude, you know, you're not going to get anywhere. You're not going to do any good. And, you know, I don't agree with it, but, you know, I don't make the big bucks.
So one thing I find interesting here is that you did have, you know, a medical director from London and somebody else there from Australia who are guests and who are speakers. And I really look at their healthcare, and I look at how healthcare is viewed as an overall system as being very different from how we do it over here in the States. Now, there's obviously a lot of talk about successes here and a lot of talk about successful programs and studies and whatnot. How much of talk was there about failures? I mean, don't you think that we really have to be willing to break a couple eggs, that not every call is going to go as smoothly as we want it to? Was there any talk about that, about really learning from our mistakes rather than just learning from our successes?
I think – sorry, Brad, go ahead.
No, Ben, you go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say was, you know, a lot of the data that they showed, you know, going back to the I hate this conversation more than anything, but innovation. You know, all the data is showing now that, you know, in cardiac arrest, you know, that's way down the line unless you suspect some kind of airway compromise that caused the arrest. You know, but that's really the only failure data you ever see. You know, oh, well, paramedics can't intubate. Paramedics can't do this. You know, and that's really the only thing that's very forthcoming. There are people that are forthcoming with is their intubation data. And it's like they're trying to disprove that we need this. You know, we need this tool. But maybe that's just me. Maybe that's just sour grapes because I'm sick of that conversation. But and that's one of those things that
The problem is we've never actually demonstrated that we improve outcomes with intubation. We have a field where a lot of our treatments are based on this seems like a good idea. Logically, if we make these assumptions, it should work. And then we never test them. So we don't know.
It's very true, Tim. Hey, Scott, another thing that was sort of mentioned, if you want to call it failure, but in one of the studies, and if I don't know, it's been a few years since it was discussed, but the idea of your hands remaining on the chest doing compressions while they deliver the shock. And one of the physicians, I believe it may have been Paul Pepe, but I'm not exactly sure who it was, discussed how that it didn't work the way that they had intended. It ended up people were getting a little bit of a charge off of it, and he briefly touched on that while he was talking about some changes in cardiac arrest. So it's one of those things where maybe not us, but some they were looking at for a change, and as they were kind of testing or trying to quantify it, they didn't end up with quite the outcome or the effects that they wanted to. And with some of the stuff they do, and they talk about with certain topics how they tried one thing and it just didn't work out for them the way they had wanted to.
And I say the word failure, and maybe I need to clarify that. Maybe that's not the right choice of words in this. I just find that we can make a heck of a lot of headway in this field, and we can, you know, put everything out there that we need to put out there to get something done and get something changed, and it just takes one little misstep to put us, you know, 10 steps back from where we had excelled to. And I think that one thing that would be important, you know, excuse me for soapboxing here for a moment, but one thing that would be important from a conference like this would be to share with anybody who might be there that, hey, you know, in the whole process improvement and improving patient treatment protocols and patient treatment guidelines, as somebody referred to it, we are going to have some little missteps, and not everything is going to go as smoothly as we want it to the first time and every time.
Well, with the hands-on defibrillation, the only real negative was one of the people who had their hands on the chest said they felt uncomfortable, and the doctor didn't say what uncomfortable meant. Everybody's going to have a different definition of uncomfortable, so you know, that didn't really clarify there was any harm. For resuscitation, the journal in the articles and press, Scott Weingart from the MCRIT podcast, he's one of the attending physicians up in the Bronx. He wrote about having felt a little bit of the current tingling sensation, depending on various factors, and saying maybe we're not ready to do this yet, but we constantly exaggerate the possibility of harm from touching the patient during defibrillation. The current is going through the patient. At best, we're getting a little bit of current that is not going through the center of the chest. The current travels between the pads. If you don't have your hands between the pads, you're probably not feeling anything. So, you know, what Dr. Weingart recommends is just have your hands clear of the chest for a second while the shock is delivered, and then immediately resume compressions. So it's timing the shock while the hands are off the chest. And we make too much of a big deal out of, oh, I'm clear, you're clear, everybody's clear, people down the hall are clear, check under the bed, see if anybody under there is clear. Where's the harm?
And that's very true.
Harm is in the delay in compressions.
Absolutely. So what do you guys, the three of you that were there, and RJ from you know, being a disciple, if you will, of one of the Eagles, I know Brad mentioned C-spine for next year. What else? Did they give any hints about what might be, you know, coming down the pipe?
Yeah, at the end they did a question and answer. And Ben, I mean, I can't remember. I know you had to take an early flight that next day. I don't remember if you took off in the afternoon or not. And Tim, I know you had to catch your flight, but it was supposed to be at a, I don't know, it may have been like everything was done an hour before said time, and they kept taking questions from the audience, what they'd like to see, and they were taking notes. And the spinal thing was discussed, and also they're going to try to have some topics next year and some people talking on how the average people and all these people attending can how they can take information and approach their medical directors to get them to adapt to some of this, sort of changing the perspective, changing the medical director involvement or their viewpoint, so that you can take it back to your service and you can start to implement some of these things that they're talking about. So that was one of the other big things. And I can't, there were a handful of other items and things on the agenda they were already discussing for next year, but those are the two big ones I remembered.
I had a line of that that spinal immobilization part is, I was talking with a friend of mine who basically designed Ohio's trauma system, and he was in a meeting and he said instead of thinking of situations where we should put somebody on a board, let's think of situations where we shouldn't put somebody on a board. And that was his line. Everyone's like, oh my gosh. And they're like, that's blasphemy. I'm like, it's actually a pretty good idea. And it's funny talking about that.
Connecticut recently approved the draft paper that the National Association of EMS Physicians did not approve, which states that putting a patient on a backboard with or without a collar, or not on a backboard, putting a patient on a stretcher without a backboard, and whether they have a collar on does not matter, is considered adequate spinal immobilization. Unfortunately, the National Association of EMS Physicians caved into the American College of Surgeons, which still worship at the altar of backboarding people. The paper they used when they changed their position, or slightly changed their position on penetrating trauma, because PHTLS no longer recommends backboards for penetrating trauma unless there's clear neurologic deficit. Not that it's likely to be beneficial then. The paper they referenced said it's not, but to support backboards for blunt trauma, they pointed to this one paper, and it showed patients getting worse after immobilization. How is that evidence that immobilization works? If they're getting worse after immobilization, that is the opposite of evidence that immobilization is beneficial. And they're so caught up in their religion of backboards that I don't think we're going to see a change anytime soon. But Connecticut is changing their state guidelines, and they're in the process of writing new protocols and educational material for it.
Well,
they adopted that position that on the stretcher with no backboard, with or without the collar, is acceptable.
Well, hopefully they'll
and that's who needs to
yeah. Hopefully they'll pave the rest of us in that direction, and I hope that, you know, everything that you and Brad are sharing is true, and that this is a topic for next year, because it needs to be. There are a lot of great stories that have come out of the Gathering of the Eagles that I've heard kind of here and there over the years, but the best one was something that Ben Neal texted me with while he was down there. Ben, you want to talk about your the session you sat in on with the doctor from Dallas?
Oh, that was, you put me on the spot with the text message.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's why I wanted to add to that a little bit. You never know.
It's okay.
Hi, Emily. That's
actually one of the things that I wrote down when I knew this is the subject we were going to cover. Was the first thing was Dr. Robert McClellan actually, gave his firsthand, what happened inside of Trauma Room 1 the day Kennedy was assassinated. And I know Brad and Tim will echo this. It was like you could feel the I don't want to say excitement, but you can just feel the respect in that room. People had their phones out recording it. When he came out, people were just clamoring to just shake the man's hand. And what was
this
really
is the
cool
guy who said that LBJ assassinated Kennedy.
Yeah, well, I did a little bit of reading afterward when I went up to my hotel room. And, his story, I guess, I don't know now if he's just up in the ages or just up in the age where he doesn't care anymore, but, but he's pretty vocal about, hit the wound. He goes, that was a front shot. But, one of the things I found really cool was, you see this guy and he's got a stain on his shirt. I'm a fat guy. My shirts just catch everything. So I understand stains on the shirt. So didn't think anything of it. Well, the next day, Dr. Pepe actually said, yeah, that was the shirt he was wearing when he worked on President Kennedy. He said, those are blood stains. And it's amazing to be that close to that kind of history. And I personally really appreciated it and enjoyed it.
Well, that was like
his story has changed so many times. We don't know what he's saying anymore. Nobody really knows where he was in the room. He claims he was right in the middle of it, and a lot of other people say, no, he was back along the wall someplace, and if he could see anything, he was lucky.
Well, I spent, and I posted on my blog a couple months ago, it's probably been about 6 or 8 months ago, they're talking about Martin Luther King. It's like, that's kind of akin to I spent 2 days at Fire Station 2, which is right across the street from the Lorraine Motel, where Martin Luther King was shot. That's kind of akin to that.
Wow. A lot of history out there, and there's a lot to see and a lot to learn from and a lot to eat.
Hey, Ben, I get to top you that on Sunday, before I had to fly out, I met Dr. Fowler over at Parkland and got a tour. So got to see, though it's not the room anymore, but did get to see where it took place. On the memorial, and I got to see Dr. What's-His-Name, his office, though of course he wasn't in it. I sure wish it would have been a Monday when I went in, because Ray said that I could have sat down in there if he wasn't busy, and he would have talked to me for hours about everything, but it was kind of nice. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, that definitely tops a handshake.
So we're kind of creeping up on just about 50 minutes here, so I want to kind of start wrapping things up. So let's just go down the list here. Brad, two things. Number one, any final thoughts on the conference, and also where can people find you?
I'm going to do them in a backwards order. Easiest way to find me, I'm really not much on Twitter anymore. You can stumble across me on Facebook, and you can find me at over at the EMS Standing Orders podcast, which, as you said, we're kind of starting to record, getting up and running. We got Tim involved now with some things, so that's probably about the best place to find me. And in closing topics or ideas, I highly recommend that. Anyone that's interested in not just getting their continuing education hours that are required, to keep up your registry, your state certification, but going and actually hearing, I think, quality content, interesting content, and hearing things that you're not hearing everywhere else that you can take back home with you and try to implement, that this is the conference to attend. And for the most part, it really isn't very expensive. The accommodations are nice. The room's nice. The meals are excellent. And you really get your money's worth. My 2 cents on it there.
Awesome. Well, Brad, thank you for coming back, and thank you for joining us tonight. I greatly appreciate you having you back on. We go back a couple years now of doing this sort of thing, so it's good to hear your voice again, man.
Good to hear you too.
Thanks. Mr. Noonan, Tim Noonan, same thing. Any final thoughts on the conference, and where can everybody find you?
There were some great presentations there. There was one by Dr. Jeff Beeson, taking the pressure off hypotensive resuscitation in traumatic injuries, which addresses how much we dump fluid into people, even though it seems to make them worse long term. It's like our constant attempt to improve return of spontaneous circulation. ROSC kills. It may be temporarily satisfying, but we do a lot of damage to make the vital signs look pretty in the short term. Dr. Gauthier Hill discussed the pediatric intubation study from LA and cleared up a lot of the misrepresentations that are out there about how the study looked at things. It was an excellent study, and it showed that pediatric intubation is not based on anything scientific. It's just based on wishful thinking. There was one by Dr. John Wee out of Portland, Oregon, I think it was, on using Geodon for restraint. And between that and droperidol and ketamine, there was a lot of talk about getting aggressive with excited delirium, which is important. And in the errors area of things, we had some talk about confirming the medications that are being given, trying to avoid medication errors. And it's an idea that needs to be worked on to work in EMS, but it's something that we need to pay attention to because medication errors happen. And we've all seen them. We've probably all made them. I know I have. What can we do to protect our patients? And I'll be writing about some of these. I'll probably also be ranting about some of these on Rogue Medic Rants over at Standing Orders. And I'll be writing at roguemedic.com.
Awesome, Tim. Well, it was great to see you down in D.C. And I know we didn't get to talk that much. I was in a little bit of a rush at that point. But it's always good to see you.
I was headed off to work.
It's always good to catch up with you, my friend. So, and again, thank you for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me.
Ben Neal, sir, esteemed colleague. Which basically in my jargon translates to drinking buddy.
Yes.
any final thoughts, and where can we find you?
I echo what Brad and Tim said. I mean, if you want quality education and if you want to be around some of the greatest minds in our field, definitely the EMS Eagles is where to be. Not taking anything away from the other expos and conferences because, there's a lot more drinking there. It's a lot more academic at the Eagles. But, I had a great time. I was kind of weary at first. Just because I was like, these guys are not on my wavelength. They're, Tim Noonan style. But I really enjoyed it, and I'm glad I went. And I'll definitely go again. Where you can find me, I'm on Twitter as at the Grinder Medic. And hopefully be putting a blog together soon, kind of throwing around some ideas, talking to Ted Setla and Scott, obviously. So hopefully next time I won't be a bumbling idiot because this is my first time, so I'm a little nervous. But thanks for having me on, Scott, Tim, Brad, everybody. Really appreciate it. And thank you all for putting up with
me. Don't worry, man. We'll edit out the bad parts. I promise.
If this is you bumbling, you have nothing to worry about.
No, you did great, man. Ben, thank you so much for coming on, man. It's good to have you on as well. Lastly but not leastly, Mr. RJ Stein. Batting cleanup, if you will.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of looking forward to seeing what changes occur with us over the next 12 months. I heard some mixed reviews about EMS today, so I'm kind of interested to see what the Eagles will lend to us. I really don't have much else. I mean, I wasn't there, so I don't know.
Fair enough. Where can we find you?
Still at hybridmedic.com and hybridmedic on Twitter. I mean, I haven't moved in a long time. So ever since I left EMS blogs, I mean, I haven't done a whole lot with FRN, but I'm hoping maybe this will give me the spark I need to get back into the game.
Yep, definitely.
But I've been sitting on the bench for a while, so
there will be some there will be some talks in the FRN world in the very near future. I can assure you of that. Once again, I would like to thank all four of you for joining me tonight and dealing with me as I kind of dusted off my. My microphone here and fired up the podcasting for the night. Once again, I'm Scott Keir, better known in the blogging and Twitter world as MedicSBK. You can find me at MedicSBK.com, on Twitter at MedicSBK, and hopefully far more frequently over at EMSGarage.com. Thank you for listening, and stay safe out there.